This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. From the Governor's Office to the Gates Foundation, education advisor J.B. Buxton has created policy and worked with officials in all levels of government on education issues. But he started out as a teacher. He's the former deputy state superintendent of the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, and he was the legislative director for the State Board of Education. Now his work focuses on charter schools. J.B. Buxton joins me now. Thank you very much for being here. So in some ways, education was a natural path for you. You didn't stray far from your family. Your father was an educator.
That's right. He was an English teacher and still runs a school up in Indiana. So he's been involved in education his entire life.
So growing up, it was all around you. You were going to school. When you were going home, you were surrounded by teachers. Education was a way of life.
That's right. I was going to school, and I was coming home, and then I was either on my dad's football field in his wrestling room or on his baseball field. And then at night, I was probably watching him correct English papers and trying to get a little help for my own.
And did he feel that education was in some way a job, or was this kind of a passionate thing for him? Did you see him trying to hone himself, make himself a better teacher? Was this a conversation in your house?
Absolutely. The thing I remember about my dad was he was invested 24 hours a day. I mean, there were kids at our house at night getting all kinds of counseling, whether it was academic or personal in nature. As a coach, he had a lot of students for whom he was an important kind of father figure role and mentor and advisor. And so I really saw education from the beginning, not as an academic purely pursuit, but as a pursuit of supporting people and supporting opportunity. I mean, it was much more than just what was happening in his English classroom at the time.
When you were growing up, was there a conversation, and one sometimes wants to be what their father is? Did you think, maybe I'll be a teacher one day? Did your father ever say to you, well, when you're a teacher one day?
No, I didn't ever think about it like that. In fact, I came down to UNC Chapel Hill, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life until the summer before my senior year when I did some teaching of my own. But at the moment I got into an education experience, a teaching experience myself, it was like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Let's back up. You came to North Carolina to become a Morehead Scholar at UNC.
That's right. I was living in New Hampshire, and I got called in, and they said, you're going to be the nominee for something called the Morehead Scholarship down at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I thought, okay, North Carolina, that's Michael Jordan. I know that. I really don't know anything else. Maybe Great Beaches. I know Great Beaches. And I thought in my mind, I don't think I want to go to North Carolina. And my parents said, just go down and check it out. And I came out of 20 degrees in snow in New Hampshire. I came down on March the 6th. I remember this stuff very well. And it was 65 degrees and shining. And I was out on the campus of Carolina. And I thought, I'm never going back to New Hampshire.
And you fell in love with it.
You know, I fell in love with Carolina for sure. Great institution. And I still feel blessed to have gone there. I really fell in love with the state. I loved North Carolina. I had roommates and housemates from Lumberton down to Robeson County, from Asheville, from Greensboro, from High Point, and I got a chance to travel the state, and I fell in love with North Carolina and kind of the culture of North Carolina and a place that really saw itself as being a state, not just a collection of small municipalities, which is kind of what my home state of New Hampshire was like, I thought, growing up. You were from Concord or Contucook, not from North Carolina, and North Carolinians had a real state identity that I loved.
So you get to North Carolina, you realize it's going to be 65 degrees in March, and this is a pretty good place, and then you leave for a time to go to South Africa while you're studying. What was that experience like? And at a time in South Africa when things were really, there was real state of turmoil going on in the early 90s.
Yeah, it was 91, and it was our summer of 91, their winter, and I was teaching at a university that was basically a non-white university. Things were still segregated under apartheid. It was transformative. I mean, it was absolutely set up everything I've done since, the experience there. And it was a time when it was clear that something was going to happen in South Africa, but it was not clear what was going to happen in South Africa. And so there was a sense of possibility and hope. There was a sense of building a country from anew in the kind of conversations that were going on. And I was lucky because I would teach during the week and then I would stay with my students on the weekends. They were all college students, but mostly had been part of the ANC and were coming back to get education. I got a kind of firsthand look at a country that was beginning to transform. and a country that was trying to figure out how to bring opportunity to 80 to 90% of the country that hadn't experienced any.
As a white man yourself, working in a non-white university, but also someone just looking at you right now who maybe easily could have been mistaken for someone who was an Afrikaner or someone who was from South Africa, what was that experience like in just walking around and seeing the way maybe still you were treated at a time when apartheid was still really raging?
Well, what was really interesting to me, and I would get people who would speak Afrikaans to me in the street, or I played rugby and people would speak Afrikaans to me on the rugby field, and I'd have to answer in English and they'd be a little surprised. What was amazing to me was the white skin was in no way a barrier to building relationships with people. There was just – they wanted to know who you were and what your interests were. They were more concerned that in America – there were a lot more poor people than they would have expected, and they want to know why I didn't do anything about that, that I came from privilege, and what was I doing to contribute in America. And so the skin color was not an issue. They kind of wanted to know your heart. And that was not something I expected, but allowed you to build relationships if you were genuine about your interests very quickly.
You've written about meeting Nelson Mandela when you were in South Africa. Where were you and what happened?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually meet him. I mean, that's the problem is I look back and I think, my gosh, I mean, I was with this man in a moment. I was attending the first legal conference of the African National Congress, the ANC, with a journalist from the Washington Post who took me on as his assistant. I just kind of had met this guy at Carolina and he was going back to South Africa and I met up with him in South Africa and he said, come with me and you'll be my assistant for the conference. Well, I didn't have anything to do there except tag around with him. So when he went off to write write his piece about what was happening at the conference, I was just wandering outside, and Mandela came out of the conference with his security retinue, and it was just me, a young woman, and her baby. And Mandela came up and greeted the woman and showed her respect, and then kind of looked at me, expecting me, I think, to shake his hand, and I was absolutely frozen. I mean, this was a man who at that time had been in prison for 27 years. When I played rugby at this university, we would sing songs about him as a way to get ourselves psyched up for the game. I mean, he was larger than life. It was like he had already been a historical figure. And when I saw him in that moment, I absolutely froze. And think back now to say, I didn't even shake the guy's hand. But it was, you know, I feel like it was. I was kind of looking in history's face.
So you said that South Africa changed the way you were and made you who you are as a teacher and certainly involved in education, but what is it that you saw and experienced there that shaped this future career of yours?
Well, for me, it was a stark contrast to the opportunities I had had growing up, the educational opportunities I'd had, the financial opportunities I'd had, my sense of opportunity and what's available to people who are willing to work hard and reach for the brass ring, so to speak. None of that existed for most people in South Africa. And I saw people for accident of birth having absolutely no opportunity and no hope of opportunity under the apartheid regime at the time. And so being involved in education and seeing these people who were doing everything they could after having stepped out of the classroom to fight the system and now coming back in, I felt very strongly that I had an obligation given all the advantages I felt I had had growing up. I mean, I came from a teacher's household. We weren't well off, but we certainly had opportunity in what we needed. I felt a real obligation for having had the opportunity to go to South Africa to come back and do something that was going to be about building opportunity for others in my own country.
When you do come back to the States and to Carolina, you go to Massachusetts after all of that, which isn't actually something that you might expect you might do. You go to a school in Massachusetts, which kind of is the absolute opposite of what you might find in South Africa.
Yeah, well, I come back from South Africa and I want to teach. And partly I want to teach because I felt like I wasn't very good in South Africa. And I want to get better at this craft and I want to be involved in young people's lives. But at this point, I haven't been an education major. I've been an English literature major. And so I'm figuring out, how do I go get a job teaching? My family's still back up in New Hampshire. My sister is a college student who I've not really seen for 4 years. And so I go back up. She's in Massachusetts, a college student, and get a job at a boarding school, which is where I knew I wouldn't need a teaching certificate. I wouldn't need anything. I could go teach there. What I found was being involved with young people, teaching, coaching was an extraordinary experience. But two things came clear to me. One was it didn't really matter if I was even in the classroom with these kids. They were going to succeed no matter what.
We should say you were at one of the elite boarding schools in New England. This is Deerfield Academy.
That's right. Yeah.
So this is the cream of the crop.
Yeah, and which was great from kind of answering a challenge in terms of going and being a teacher. They didn't really need me at that point, and that was clear to me that that's not where I was going to find my mark and do what I thought I wanted to do. The second thing was, and I think it was because of the magnitude of what was happening in South Africa and the sense that you had a whole country and the sense that I remembered seeing my dad impacting lots of people. I wanted to find a bigger impact, and I didn't want to do exactly what my dad had done. I literally was teaching the same books, the same poems, coaching the same sports that he had done. And I realized, I got to cut my own path here, and I've got to find a way to get back to kind of the principles of impact I felt like came clear to me in South Africa.
So you could have stayed there probably and lived a comfortable life and mimicked something that your father did. Was it more that you were trying to push yourself, or you were saying, I can't just do this. I have to be able to reach out and touch more people in a way. I can't just sit back on my heels. I'm too young.
Well, I really had a sense of ambition about making a difference. A small classroom in a boarding school was not, at that time, going to be the way I thought I was going to get it done. People can make great impacts at those institutions and work with students who do great things in the world. And so I don't have any issue with people who make that choice. It just wasn't the right choice for me. There was also a certain young woman at that time who I'd met at Carolina who was going to be my wife, and she's North Carolinian. And I decided I'd rather go live where Hunter was, down here in North Carolina. I'd love to come back to a state I fell in love with and try to figure out how to get involved in public education here.
So you come back, and what happens next? You've been to South Africa, you've been to Deerfield, and what's your next step?
Well, I'm very fortunate at this point, and I'm put in touch with a guy named John Dornan, who ran the public school forum of North Carolina, which at that time was kind of the most influential public education advocacy organization. And they're looking for someone to help them run, be another staff member with the North Carolina Teaching Fellows Program. And so here is the preeminent teaching scholarship in the country, kind of first of its kind. Many imitators come later.
Will you describe what this is, what the program was, and what it offered people?
Back in the late 80s, to just do a short, North Carolina's looking at how to improve the quality of its teaching field and how to get people into education. And it comes up with an idea that it's going to create a competitive scholarship to get in to teaching that's going to pay your way through if you commit to 4 years of teaching afterwards. And it's going to have you training as a teacher from day one. So for 4 years, you are training to be a teacher in the public schools in North Carolina with a commitment to pay back your scholarship through 4 years of service. The great thing about the program, to kind of jump ahead a little bit and why I thought it was such an incredible opportunity, was it was pretty clear to me that this was more about inculcating in a group of young 18-year-olds who are thinking about teaching the notion that teaching is a commitment to your community, not just to a classroom. And the preparation and the experiences that teaching fellows had were all about teaching them, one, the many cultures and communities of the state, and two, their role in improving public education and how they can be leaders in public education, not just what you had to do to teach the standards in English or math or elementary or high school or whatever it might be. It was a larger calling to be involved in public education. And so for me, the opportunity to be involved there answered that call of a chance to be involved in a major issue initiative that would impact lots of people, not just the teachers going in, but then the students they would work with. And I felt very fortunate. I was kind of in the right place at the right time.
There's a story about you taking the fellows on a bus tour. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it was what the fellows program did. And it's a fellows program, unfortunately, was ended a couple of years ago here in North Carolina, when I think the less smart decisions we've made in public education recently. But the idea was, for the first summer after their first year at school, these new teaching fellows would, actually right before they went to school, would go on an 8-day bus trip, essentially a huge road trip across North Carolina. And in later years, it went from Raleigh east, and the next year it would go Raleigh west because there was so much to do. But it was meant to show these students two things. One, this notion that you're entering into service to the state of North Carolina, not just to some school where you might think you want to go after you teach. You're involved in service to the state. The second was they wanted to help these students understand the role that public schools played in their communities and how important these institutions were to these communities. And when we'd go in, you wouldn't just go visit schools. You'd go visit cultural centers. You'd meet with local officials who would talk to you about public schools. You'd do cultural initiatives in the local community. So people would learn their state in a way they never would have known from just living, growing up in their own community.
I'm speaking with J.B. Buxton, and you're listening to The State of Things. So working within this fellows program starts you on a path of going towards more policy work, not getting out of the classroom and really thinking about education on the whole and what it can do for North Carolina. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I had the whole time I was with the fellows been thinking about going back to school, graduate school, in English, so I could go back and teach in English. But I get an opportunity at the Public School Forum to become their policy director and get involved with their work with the legislature and the governor and the various constituencies in public education. And that was a great opportunity. And it got me involved in the policy side of things. And it led me down a road that has very much been about education policy and politics ever since.
But what was that like, you know, transitioning from a teaching role where your world is this group of students and you can see it and you're making them better, to a world where you're now dealing with bureaucracy and political objectives and such? I mean, how do you – must have been kind of frustrating.
Well, it was. I'll tell you something. I used to carry a basketball in my trunk because every day at about 2:30 when I used to be out coaching, I'd find myself – a little jittery, and I'd go out and I'd go shoot hoops somewhere, just do something active because I had to get out. What happened, though, was as I got involved in the policy world, and I'll give you one specific example. We took on a major study of the teaching profession, what it was going to take to keep more of our teachers in teaching. At that time, this is 1996, and we're losing 50% of our teachers in the first 5 years of teaching. We're losing 30% in the first three. I mean, it's a huge issue in turnover for the state of North Carolina. And one of the things that we get done after the study is we help pass a bill that brings or pass legislation, and Governor Hunt at this time is carrying this legislation, but it originated with a forum recommendation to get a mentor for every first and second year teacher in North Carolina. So now every teacher has a mentor so that as they're beginning their profession and getting in and facing all the difficulties of teaching, they've got someone to take that through. It took about $18 million to get it done for every first and second year teacher. We watched retention uptick a little bit. But it was that sense of you can make, if you work hard, study, get involved, you can make a big difference for lots of people. And that was kind of one of the early policy issues that, you know, not a world-breaking thing, world change. But it made a big difference for thousands of teachers who all of a sudden had some more support than they had before, and I enjoyed playing a role.
My guest this hour is J.B. Buxton. We'll have more with him just ahead about what happened next in his career. You're listening to The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Phoebe Judge. My guest is education consultant J.B. Buxton. Before the break, we were talking about your shift to policy work. Tell us about the transition into working in the Easley administration.
I had come back from working in the last year of the Clinton administration on public education at the White House, and I was excited to come back to North Carolina. I appreciate everyone who works in the federal government, but it's a very long way from making an impact on the classroom. And so the chance to get back into the state level work was exciting. And I did a short stint with the State Board of Education, but then moved over to become Mike Easley's education advisor. What I would consider maybe the most impactful job I've ever had, aside from teaching. And I was essentially his senior education advisor on K-12 and higher education policy.
The most impactful because you were able to see what you were recommending and the policies you were setting forth having an impact on the whole state and all the students?
Yeah, precisely. But again, this is never something that that one person does, or I mean, this is being part of a broader ecosystem, policy ecosystem, with legislators, obviously a governor's leadership, with a state board, with the teachers in the classroom. So to be part of, and when I think about impactful, I mean, we went from having no public pre-kindergarten program to having 35,000 at-risk kids in pre-kindergarten programs. We went from a high school graduation rate with a number of different initiatives, about 58%, up into the 70s, and now we're sitting in the 80s, I think, by the groundwork laid there. We went from having no focus on the working conditions of teachers to the first ever teacher working conditions survey in the country, and now about, I don't know, 10 to 20 states are doing the same kind of thing. We went from not dealing with more than 15 or so low-performing schools every year to essentially taking over about 130 and trying to bring greater educational opportunity. It was a time of action. It was a time of excitement. We put 70 early college high schools in across the state for first-generation college students so they could get a high school diploma and 2 years of college credit, an AA degree at the same time. I mean, you could really see issues, ideas, and action play out in your experience.
And maybe more important in a state like North Carolina, which has this very centralized system, K through 12 education, you know, so you're not dealing with county boards so much, you're really dealing at a statewide level. It would mean more to be working in that type of position. Is that true for a state like this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, North Carolina is among the more centralized from a policy and financial standpoint states in the country on public education. So, I mean, essentially, policy originates at the state level with strong leadership, and sometimes that comes out of a governor's office and sometimes that comes out of a legislature. But it has long been the tradition of North Carolina of strong state action in public education. I think that's changing a little bit nowadays, especially with, I think, some strong local innovation that's beginning to happen. But for a long time, innovation was seen as coming from the state level, and that was a time when I was involved. It was still very much the case.
Still, that centralized approach must create some unique challenges.
The challenge that you see is that you get school systems that wait for the state to make a move.
So they'll take care of it.
In rare cases, would you see a state say, we need a radically new approach to how we do high school in the state. We're going to take that on. Or we need more students coming to our school system that have been in pre-kindergarten education. We need to get that done. And you would see a few cases every now and then. But overall, I'd say kind of the focus of a legislative agenda or lobbying was, how do we get the state to take this on? And when you're working for a governor, that means you get to take a lot of action. And people are looking at your administration, the governor's administration, to get something done.
But it might mean that the initiative on a local level becomes a little dull, right? You know, you can sit back a little bit and just wait for the bigger guns to give you your orders.
Yeah, and I think we had some of that was happening. And that, I think, can be a frustration, because if you get administrations that don't focus on things that are really moving the needle for children, then you don't get a lot of momentum.
You go from working in the governor's office to running for the state superintendent of public education. What was that experience like?
It was tremendous. The opportunity to go across the state and meet people and talk about and of their hopes and dreams and ambitions for public schools was, I feel lucky to have had the opportunity. I didn't much like losing, which I did in the primary, but to a great person, June Atkinson, who's been a good state superintendent and enjoyed running with her. But really that chance to be across the state and understand what people want out of their public schools in a way you just can't when you're working strictly out of Raleigh, I'm thankful to have had it, even if I had to lick some wounds afterwards.
You have three children. Did all three go to public school?
Yeah, all three, and two of them are still in the public schools, and one's at a public university over at Chapel Hill.
Did having your children in public schools and you working so closely with the public schools in the state, did that experience shape your perspective in terms of educational policy? What I'm doing here is reflecting on what my kids are learning, or vice versa. I know what's going on in their school. Let me figure out a way to talk about this on a bigger statewide level.
I think you can't help as a parent thinking about your experience with your children and having it impact how you think about policy. You got to be very careful at the state level that you don't let your own personal experience impact the way you think things play out everywhere. And I will tell you that the public schools of Wake County look different than the public schools of Halifax County or Robertson County or Transylvania County up in the mountains or in Guilford County. So you have to be careful to make sure you're checking those biases from your own experience at the door. But certainly you understand the way that parents feel about the education of their children and the critical importance they feel about who's teaching their children every day in a classroom or about the people charged with leading their buildings or about how we're funding schools in the state. So, yeah, you bring a parent's perspective, and I think that's important.
Would you have thought twice about sending your children to public schools if it wasn't the Wake County schools but rather the Transylvania County schools or another county in this state which doesn't have the funding or doesn't have the quality of teachers? We can make any judgment you like, but, you know, would it have been as easy to say my kids are going to public school if you weren't in Wake County?
Yes. Yes, it would have been as easy. And the reason why is I've always felt, and felt this growing up, that your local schools, you learned a lot about your community. You learned a lot about working with a broad range of people. You were part of the fabric of the community. I mean, it has been our experience in the public schools in Wake County has been as good as I would have expected, if not better in many cases. And I know my kids would say that. Public schools have been very important to me as a place that my children went to school.
You were working on education policy in the state when charter schools were initially proposed. What happened?
Well, I was working on the public school forum, and we actually worked with the legislature at that time to bring some early advocates for charter schools. They were from Minnesota, in fact. It was the first state to really start doing this work. And we brought them in and did a legislative briefing on it to get it, just kind of think through what might this look like for North Carolina. That was in the mid-90s. There was a lot of interest in this nascent movement, partly because of what it might mean for creating some new innovations in the public schools. But really, there's a lot of interest in two things. One was thinking about, at that time, we had had a change from an all-Democratic legislature to a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. There's a lot of talk about vouchers in the state, and there are a lot of people interested in not going to vouchers but to going to charters as kind of a half step on the choice agenda. I think folks, strong public school advocates, also saw charters as creating the opportunity to serve kids who weren't being well served by the public system, and that charters could offer that opportunity. There wasn't a lot of data at that time, but it felt like there was a different model that might be out there. But there were just very interesting political cross currents at that time.
Many of your fellow Democrats oppose charter schools. You don't, in certain circumstances. Why are they opposing charter schools so loudly, and why do you not?
Well, I don't want to speak for anyone, but I'll give you my general impression of the situation. I mean, the interesting thing was Democrats who actually proposed the legislation and brought charter schools into North Carolina, the Senate. Had the bill, the Democratic Senate had the bill that put it in. A Durham legislator, actually a Democrat, was the one who shepherded it through the General Assembly.
And that's changed a bit now over
and
these
it is,
years.
It's
certainly
changed. Part of what happened to charter schools was we had a bunch come in and people realized they were no silver bullet. They didn't look like some incredible innovation lab. That they looked a lot like the way we think about our public schools. There were some that were not so good and there were some that were great and there were a lot of them that were just doing okay. And so a lot of the interest around charter schools cooled through the late 90s into the early 2000s, mid-2000s. There wasn't a lot of policy discussion about it in the state. The biggest discussion was whether or not we would have a cap or not on charter schools and whether we should lift the cap. And there was kind of a mixed sentiment, but you would get rural Republican legislators who didn't like charter schools and you would get urban Democrats who didn't or did. It was kind of all over the map. That really changed when the Republican legislature came into town, and I think felt like there had been inaction on this front, and it became part of their policy playbook. And I think it politicized unnecessarily at that time the charter school issue because Democrats kind of reacted against that strong charter and choice agenda that Republicans were proposing, and we saw a kind of polarization on the charter school debate at that time.
You're presently working on a charter school in Southeast Raleigh. Tell us about it.
I'm the board chair, and so I serve on the board of directors of the charter school. It's called PAVE, Southeast Raleigh Charter School, and it's a replication of a school in Red Hook, which is up in Brooklyn, and a pretty poor community in the Brooklyn area. if I took you to the school and you walked out the front door and you looked across the street, you'd see a large housing complex. And the school, in many ways, was meant to serve residents of that housing complex and families in the Red Hook area. So it serves low-income families and children from that area. And it has an instructional program that is very much geared towards kids who come in, perhaps at risk, perhaps behind grade level, below grade level, and getting them to a place where they're succeeding and maintaining that. It is a very dynamic environment. It is a strong instructional program. It's an extended year. It's an extended day. It's got arts and music. You walk in, and it feels like a school where you want your kids. Southeast Raleigh needs that kind of school and that kind of opportunity. And when they looked pave Red Hook, looked at doing an expansion and coming down and have an opportunity for a great school leader who was going to be coming down in the area and looking in the triangle, they saw some opportunity in Southeast Raleigh to really replicate that focus on low-income families who need a different model and who need an intensive model and who need an extended day and an extended year. And for me, it brought me back to the kind of first principles that I had been interested in charter schools back in the 90s, to meet unmet needs for kids who are in our public schools but just not receiving everything they need. And to me, that's what the promise of charter schools was when we first started talking about them. It's a promise that hasn't really been realized. And I saw this school, number one, as being serious about that population, free breakfast, free lunch, free transportation, longer school year, but also a school that may be able to change the conversation in Wake County and maybe more broadly about how charter schools can impact at-risk families, kids for whom the public system maybe isn't, the traditional public school isn't doing everything it needs to do.
I'm speaking with J.B. Buxton on the state of things. So the argument from some is that that's great. You're opening a charter school in Southeast Raleigh that will serve a community that needs it, low-income students who need free breakfast and lunch and transportation. But that's only going to serve 120 kids. There are a lot more than 120 kids who need those that type of high-quality education in Southeast Raleigh. What about them? So as someone who's been involved in this field for so long, what do you say to that argument, which we hear a lot from people who have problems with charter schools?
Right. And it'll serve, so we'll get upwards of 580, 600. That'll be in the school. So not just 120. 120 start in kindergarten, first grade this year. That's why charters are a piece of the puzzle. They're not the puzzle. They're not the solution. They're a piece of the puzzle if they're helping solve or they're helping support children that may need a different approach than they currently have access to. That's what charters can do. So a strong public school system that meets the needs of students across the board is critical. I mean, my children's schools are in Southeast Raleigh. So I've got elementary, middle, and high. My kids have been in Southeast Raleigh schools their whole careers. Those schools have to be excellent schools. But they're not meeting the needs of every kid who's coming through. And the kids that we're talking about for PAVE Southeast Raleigh bring some enormous challenges to school, often need small environments, often need that extended time. And you can be part of the puzzle, part of the solution in the system. There are other charters I think we have in Wake County and around the state that I don't see as part of the solution.
So charter schools isn't the cure-all for everything. What you're arguing is that there are a few good ones out there that will be integral in helping certain neighborhoods and sections of this state.
What I'm saying is that charter schools are a tool that we ought to use to meet the overarching goal of a sound-based education for all kids. And we should be loath to close off anything under the public umbrella that provides high-quality education for students, and we should be very tough about not letting those things become political issues. Those are strong instructional strategies and decisions. Wake County, I think, ought to embrace a school like this that wants to come in and be part of that broader public purpose, focus on a student population that has had some challenges in a community that has had. And at the same time, I really applaud Wake County for saying, hey, we might want to start some of these on our own and get some of the flexibility and some of the focus that we see some of these other charters getting. So, absolutely.
What do you see very quickly for the future of education in the state?
I see us clearly wrestling with the choice issue. I would hope we don't move down a voucher issue, which I see as a kind of unaccountable system where we have no idea the kind of education our children are getting. I would see us on the charter front, I hope, moving to a place where it's not let a thousand flowers bloom, but a very strategic focus on schools that meet needs. I think we are getting serious about the quality of teachers in our classroom. That's important. I think we have been serious about the quality of our pre-kindergarten opportunities, but I think we've fallen down on that, and that's going to be a major issue for us. And I see us as having the potential to innovate on the high school, the college connection. We did, under Mike Easley, we did 70 early college high schools, first-generation college kids. We've kind of shut down on the innovation game since then, and it's time to get back on that.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
J.B. Buxton is an education consultant in Raleigh. You can find out more about today's show at stateofthings.org. That's the State of Things for today. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee and Anita Rao. Hadi Mawagdi and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is the technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Phoebe Judge.